Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungine, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses the latest negotiation in Brussels and the latest politics in London and Dublin.
It's been a week of volcanic political drama after 17 months of talks. And despite dizzying mood swings last week and all weekend, EU and British negotiators dramatically sealed the treaty at 9 o'clock on Monday night, and RTE News broke the story.
Now, rather than prompt chimes of jubilation that would ring out across the shires and villages of England, news of the deal prompted a fresh bout of bloodletting in the Conservative Party that were shocking even by recent standards.
On Thursday, Theresa May lost five ministers, including the Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab. A backbench revolt led by Jacob Rees-Mogg has set in motion a possible vote of no confidence in Theresa May, followed by a leadership challenge.
Or has it? Things are changing by the minute, so let's stick with what's happened and what we know. In a moment, we'll describe how RTE broke the story of the deal and what exactly is in the withdrawal treaty and what it means for Ireland. But first, Tony, tell us how things were looking at the beginning of this week.
Yeah, things were not looking too good. Colm, you'll remember from the previous week there was that big row between the DUP and Theresa May, the DUP writing a letter to the Prime Minister and she writing in return promising that there would be no customs border on the Irish Sea and that the DUP had nothing to worry about. But clearly all her protestations of nothing really changing between Northern Ireland and Great Britain did not go down too well in the DUP. So there's a generally sour mood in Westminster and Belfast. And then over the weekend, the negotiators were back. I think Ollie Robbins came back to meet Sabine Vaillant on Sunday. They went back into what we have been calling the tunnel. But on Monday morning, things were not looking too good. All the signals were that there were still big gaps between both sides on the fundamental issues. And of course, there was a feeling as well that time was running out, because if we were going to get a summit, an emergency summit in November, then things had to really conclude this week, because you need space and time for the machinery to fire up and the member states to go through the text and to find out what their positions are on the text before you can have a European Council meeting. So things were not looking too good. I mean, just to remind people of the fundamental issues that were dividing the two sides, of course, it was all about the backstop. 95% of the withdrawal agreement had been agreed. The 5% was really about Ireland. What would this backstop look like? Would there be two backstops? Would it be a single backstop with special provisions for Northern Ireland? Would there be a time limit, an expiry date to it? How would the UK get control of that expiry date if there were such a thing? And of course, what would the customs element of this look like? Because the way the UK has been approaching this is they wanted to get rid of the original backstop, if we can call it that, the Northern Ireland specific backstop, and instead have this temporary customs arrangement. But in turn, that triggered a whole range of questions that member states were anxious to ask. And that was, OK, if we're going to give you a temporary customs union, which means the UK, will have quota and tariff and rules of origin free access to the EU single market, then you're going to have to swallow some conditions for that. So that was the climate and the set of variables and obstacles to a deal on Monday morning. The mood that we were picking up was not that positive.
Right. Mixed signals over the prospects of a deal. Now, as you say, Ollie Robbins, Theresa May's envoy in all of this, and Sabine Vaillant, the EU's negotiating counterpart for him, went into the tunnel. It became a tunnel of love, obviously. Tell us how RTE News broke the story.
Well, first of all, just around the time the text was being finalised, I spoke to a senior European Union official who is normally quite reliable, and he said that he was pretty sure there wasn't going to be agreement this week, both sides were still quite far apart. And the issue, according to him, was that in order to create this temporary customs union, you know, it's a big, complex legal thing. And effectively, the European Commission task force was saying, look, you guys have to go off and design this thing in London and then come back when you've done that. Because, you know, obviously it's a customs union that is going to be shoehorned into the divorce treaty. And that is a complicated piece of work. So the feeling in Brussels was that they simply were taking too long to do this and it was going to take the rest of the week. However, it seems like throughout Monday, they did get a lot of work done. A lot of the obstacles were bridged over and closed off. Now, I should say that Michel Barnier was part of the tunnel on Sunday. In fact, they worked in the tunnel until about 2:45 on Monday morning. And on Monday morning at 9 o'clock, Michel Barnier had a meeting to brief member states in the General Affairs Council, that is the group that comprises of EU European Affairs ministers. And then he had a private meeting with Simon Coveney and Helen McEntee, the Irish Europe minister, and the Irish delegation. And in that private meeting, I think he told the Irish delegation that a deal was there to be done, that things were close. And while everything was extremely sensitive at that point, in fact, Michel Barnier cancelled a news conference that he was due to give, which meant that the Irish meeting happened 20 minutes early. And it also meant that when Simon Coveney finished that meeting, he gave an extremely short and circumspect statement to the media, who were somewhat cheesed off that his statement was so short and there was some choice language picked up by the Council Audio Visual Service, but that's another story.
Right.
So that was where things left. Now on Tuesday afternoon, I managed to get through to one particular source who said, "Well, look, a text was stabilised last night at 9 o'clock. So that was Monday night." And I said, "So stabilised, that means concluded, are the negotiations over?" And they said, "Well, the text is as stable as it can be. Now it's gone back to London, and the source I spoke to presumed that things were so tricky for Theresa May that she decided not to give the text to the cabinet that was meeting that morning." This is, of course, Tuesday morning, and so everybody was in the dark that this text had been agreed. Now, obviously, under RTE's editorial guidelines, you need a second source for a story like this. And I did go to a second source who effectively said, yes, you're right, the text was stabilised last night. It's as stable as it can be. It wouldn't be correct to say that the negotiations have concluded, but this is where it's at. There is now a deal, and it has now gone into the politics in London. So with the two sources, confirming what I had suspected, RTE was able to break the story at 4 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon, and that was a worldwide scoop, if you like. The foreign currency markets reacted. Sterling rose to $1.30, and then all of the choreography suddenly kicked in. Downing Street confirmed that there was going to be an emergency cabinet meeting on Wednesday. Theresa May started to meet her cabinet ministers one by one for briefing sessions in Downing Street. And then it was game on. And everything then was going to hinge on the cabinet meeting the next day.
How did it all go down in Dublin? Simon Coveney said was very circumspect after the briefing by Michel Barnier. What was the reaction in Dublin to the story breaking?
Well, in fact, it turns out that the Irish system was clearly aware that a text had been stabilised on Monday night, because Leo Varadkar actually briefed the cabinet at a special sitting on Tuesday morning as to where things were at. Now, the fact that there was no leak from that cabinet meeting is quite astonishing. That has to be a first. But they did manage to keep the lid on this particular development. Now, when RTE broke the story on Tuesday afternoon, the Department of Foreign Affairs issued a statement saying it was wrong to say that the negotiations had concluded and that work was still ongoing, and that people were not to pay attention to media, or that they weren't commenting, rather, on media leaks. Now, to be fair to RTE, we did say that it wasn't correct to say that the negotiations had concluded per se, but that there was a text that had stabilised. Now I understand that there was extreme sensitivity in Dublin that nothing would be said about this until Michel Barnier would pronounce on the result, on the withdrawal text, that he would publish the withdrawal text, and that there would be a political meeting between Michel Barnier and Dominic Raab, the Brexit secretary. So everybody in Dublin was keeping very stum altogether, because of course we all remember what happened back in December of last year, when it looked like a deal was done on the 4th of December on the joint report, but then obviously Theresa May discovered that the union, the DUP, were not of the opinion that the deal was done, and they walked out on it. So I think nobody in Dublin wanted to make a repeat of that particular episode.
Right. Well, we've been reporting on this podcast, Brexit Republic, on what the hot button issues were in these negotiations. The backstop, as you mentioned, everything was agreed except the backstop, really, and whether or not Ireland's objectives will be met. Can we say at this stage whether Ireland's interests have been protected, or whether we've been thrown under a bus, as was being widely predicted in the British media in the lead up to all of this?
I suppose the first thing to say, Colin, would be that the Irish government was looking for a separate backstop to the UK-wide customs arrangement, because if that didn't work out, then where would we be? You know, we wouldn't have this insurance policy or this ultimate safety net. But I think both Ireland and the EU decided to concede on that point. So there is only one backstop, the UK-wide customs arrangement. But critically, there are key provisions for Northern Ireland attached to that backstop and embedded in the withdrawal treaty in a number of articles. So essentially, you know, to remind people...
Save us the trouble of the 585-page read and tell us what's the specifics on this as far as Ireland is concerned.
Well, the specifics are really in the protocol on Ireland. It is on page 302, I think, of the withdrawal treaty. It's about 30 pages long. There are five or six annexes, which are all quite detailed in themselves. But the point of the Irish backstop is that, yes, it is a UK-wide customs arrangement, so therefore you're not going to have any customs barrier on the Irish Sea, but you will have special provisions for Northern Ireland to make sure that goods are produced under EU regulations. So you'll have alignment on the rules of the single market in Northern Ireland. Now, that has two implications. One is that any goods that are produced in Northern Ireland can then circulate freely throughout the Irish Republic and beyond, obviously, into the EU 27. But it means that goods that are produced in the UK that are not produced under EU regulations, then those goods will have to be checked. Now, this is where we get into the de-dramatisation issue, which we've talked about before. Now, again, it's important to stress that this only kicks in if at the end of the two-year transition, or if it's a three-year transition, if the transition is extended, there's still no free trade agreement in place, or if that free trade agreement doesn't actually cut muster with the EU in terms of avoiding a hard border. It's only in those circumstances that the backstop would kick in. But while the customs element would be handled by this UK-wide arrangement, the single market regulatory element would be an add-on, a separate provision that's in the treaty for Northern Ireland. So, for example, if you produce something in Northern Ireland, let's say you produce milk, and you want to export that milk to the Irish Republic or to anywhere else in the EU, or if you want that milk to be part of a free trade agreement that the EU has with West Africa, then you will be able to take part in that trade because you're still complying with EU regulations, and those are all provided for in the treaty. Northern Ireland will stay the same for VAT and excise. It'll stay the same for agri-food products. It will stay the same for state aid and competition rules. Now, that begs the question, what if you're getting goods in Northern Ireland from Great Britain? Now, anything that's produced in Great Britain won't be complying with those EU regulations. So therefore, do you have to have checks? And it seems that there will be checks, and these checks will be the de-dramatised checks that we've talked about before, this idea
of checks at the point of origin and checks at the destination, as opposed to, on some checks, increased checks at ports, but not all trucks being stopped at the ports and being searched individually.
Well, let's break that down a bit, because if you talk about rules of origin. Now, rules of origin are to do with customs, so there will be no rules of origin implications so long as this temporary customs union is in place. What these checks refer to are checks relating to the safety of goods. Do they comply with EU safety standards, regulations, and so on? Let's say they're toys for children. Are they safe enough, etc.? So those checks will have to take place. Now, what they're saying is that they don't take place at ports, so they won't take place at Liverpool. They would take place in the factory floor, for example, or in a depot. And not everything will be checked. There will be a percentage of things that will be checked based on risk. So that's the whole point of de-dramatisation. You know what the trade flows are about. You know that, Northern Ireland is a small economy. You can keep an eye on what's coming in, where it's ending up. So if there's a sudden spike in a certain commodity or good or product, then you can do checks on that basis. So in a sense, the UK has won the battle on the single UK-wide customs backstop, but on the other hand, there will have to be checks on some goods going into Northern Ireland from Great Britain. The other thing is that goods produced in Northern Ireland can have a separate certification. They can be called UKNI. They can get that certification, which means they're produced in Northern Ireland, meaning they can be sent to the Great Britain market, the UK market, or they can be sent to the EU single market. So that's really the way this is going to work out in terms of the regulatory question. Now, even though
Northern Irish business interests have welcomed this today. The Ulster Farmers Union, the CBI, Northern Ireland and Britain's equivalent of IBEC, the Institute of Directors have all welcomed this as a step forward. They probably welcome the clarity at least.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's extremely significant because I certainly, on the one hand, a lot of these organisations, the Irish government would feel perhaps that they weren't vocal enough before the referendum. Certainly the Ulster Farmers Union was very reticent before the referendum because they, as a constituency, are very close to the DUP, a good proportion of them. For them to speak up now is quite significant because that puts pressure on the DUP to, maybe take a second look at this withdrawal treaty before dismissing it out of hand. And it does feed into this narrative that, Northern Ireland businesses are getting the best of both worlds. They are able to access the single market and they're able to access the UK market. Now, there will be an implication, of course, that some stuff may have to be checked going across. But those checks, as I say, they're trying to say, look, these are minimal checks. The other thing I was going to make there about the customs union, even though this treaty spells out in numerous articles that Northern Ireland is part of the UK's customs territory, it's not part of the EU's customs territory, it is still subject to what's called the European Union Customs Code. So it's a slightly paradoxical thing to explain to people, but The way to look at it is that you have the classic EU customs union, but that's also a regulatory union because the customs union is kind of a delivery system for doing all those other checks for regulatory compliance, for safety, for food hygiene and so on. Now, the UK is going to be in a basic customs union, which means that Northern Ireland will be in a different kind of customs union. So it's going to have the Union Customs Code applied. Now, they were quite clever when they were drafting this treaty because they buried all this stuff in different articles. They never spelled it out as such. They just said that, you know, according to Article 6 or whatever, you know, if you're in that territory, then Regulation 953 or whatever will apply. Now, that's obviously the EU's customs code. But that's how they've tried to do it. And that has obviously managed to get this across the line in terms of the British government.
Right. It's like consubstantiation versus transubstantiation, but I think I followed you there. I mean, there's a picture from Emmanuel Donon, the photographer, AFP Getty, of Donald Tusk and Michel Barnier. It's published in the Financial Times today, like two admiring fathers looking at their 585-page baby. It may be the biggest waste of trees in the history of politics if the treaty is rejected. I mean, is there any way to make sense in the carnage of Westminster and what it means for this treaty?
Yeah, I mean, everyone is kind of watching and waiting. I mean, we have this omerta in Brussels at the moment where everyone's terrified of saying anything, but privately people are just looking on in London and they're frankly terrified and horrified by what's been happening. Having said all that, there is a certain amount of you know, member states factoring this in. You know, they know there's a parallel universe out there. There's the universe of the negotiating room, and then there's what's happening in Westminster. So they've kind of grown accustomed to the unpredictability of London and the House of Commons. But clearly, you know, if Theresa May faces a no confidence motion that she loses, then that puts the whole thing into disarray, and it's unlikely that the House of Commons in that situation would approve the withdrawal treaty. But what we're looking at the moment is, okay, we don't know if this no confidence motion is going to actually happen. There are some debates over whether or not Jacob Rees-Mogg and company have got the numbers, the 48 signatures or letters needed to the 1922 committee to trigger this motion. And if they do even trigger it, then, you know, that you're going to have 150 or so MPs voting against Theresa May and triggering a leadership challenge. Now, what would the public in the UK think of a Conservative Party leadership challenge while the country is heading towards a no-deal cliff edge? Unedifying, I would say. So there are,
and if she wins, they can't do it again for another 12 months.
If she wins, exactly, they can't touch her for a year. So, and obviously, the other question is, you know, what candidate could stand against her that would put forward an alternative vision that is a credible vision? Because it seems to me, from my vantage point in Brussels, that it's inconceivable that a Brexiteer could be elected and then could come to Brussels and get the EU to simply throw the withdrawal treaty in the bin and start from scratch. There's no appetite whatsoever in Brussels that I've detected for any reopening of this negotiation.
And the Taoiseach was out today, indeed, saying very much the same thing. I think indeed we have a clip of that press conference he did at the launch of a social housing project in Dublin today.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't see much room for renegotiation. This is a withdrawal agreement which took the best part of 2 years to negotiate, involving 28 countries, all of whom have their particular concerns and interests. So I think if you start trying to amend it or unpick it, you might find that the whole thing unravels. Now, it is still a draft withdrawal agreement, of course, so it has yet to be agreed by the European Council. We expect to do that next weekend. Has now been agreed by the UK government. Appreciate that Prime Minister May is going to have quite a battle to get it through the House of Commons. But she's someone who has shown, I think, enormous resilience in the past. I think as well, certainly in our dealings with her, she's been true to her word. So hopefully she'll be able to get through. I know, looking at things today, it looks like it's going to be very difficult to win the vote in the House of Commons. But I think as reality kicks in, as the precipice approaches, you may find more and more people becoming willing to support this deal as the best possible outcome that can be achieved. And I see today, you know, groups like the Ulster Farmers Union, the Northern Ireland Chamber of Commerce, giving their broad support to the agreement on the basis that it protects industry and jobs in Northern Ireland, which, you know, has to be one of the major concerns that we have. Well, I think in a no-deal scenario, it would be very difficult to avoid a hard border because of the obvious fact that as Ireland remaining part of the European Union, we would no doubt be asked to implement European law, and then also the United Kingdom, having left the European Union, would seek to join the World Trade Organization, and they would have to implement World Trade Organization rules. So those hard Brexiteers who say that somehow just through good political will you can avoid a hard border, that doesn't make sense. Are they really saying that they would join the WTO and then the first thing they would do would be to refuse to implement the WTO rules? Are they really saying to us that we would stay in the European Union and not protect the single market? So, you know, the only way we can avoid a hard border is by an agreement that covers customs and regulations. We have that now.
Is he right, Tony? That's the feeling in Brussels. This is the end of it, and it's time to move on with this as the hard foundation for any future talks or dealings.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that if you look at the treaty, there is a lot of language in there that says that the protocol on Ireland in no way threatens the constitutional integrity of the UK. There's a clause in there which says both sides will use their best endeavours to find something to replace the backstop or to make sure it's never needed. There will be a kind of rendezvous in July 2020 whereby everyone will look at how things are going. So in July 2020, of course, we'll be a year into the transition. The free trade negotiations will have got underway. They will take a look at that and say, well, how are we getting on? Are we near close to conclusion? Including that free trade agreement, will that free trade agreement give rise to no checks on the Irish border, and so on? And they've got three options there in this rendezvous. One is that the free trade agreement does actually work and it's all ready to go. Number two, option B, if you like, is extend the transition. So you could do that by maybe 6 months or a year. They haven't figured out yet what that figure will be or what that transition extension will look like. And again, option C, which is the backstop. But they've put a lot of language in there to try and reassure people that the backstop is the last resort and that in no way does this treaty threaten the constitutional integrity of the UK. So there are some forlorn hopes, I think you could probably describe them in Brussels, that people, when the dust settles, if this confidence motion comes and goes, that they will actually look at this treaty and say, well, it's maybe not that bad. And again, the point you were making, will the DUP suddenly feel that they're looking a little bit naked with the tide going out? And find that they may have to calibrate their response, although so far they still seem to be fairly hardline on everything.
Is there any discussion in Brussels about the people's vote, the prospect of a second referendum, or at this stage have European governments and officials in Brussels largely come to the conclusion that Brexit is happening and at this stage we can deal with it?
You know, I think while in people's hearts, and Donald Tusk often is the most eloquent advocate of this, you know, that Britain might somehow change its mind. I think simply the dynamics of this and the very limited time that's left militates against a second vote, because if you have a second vote or a people's vote, as they're calling it, you would need to run that through the House of Commons. You'd need to figure out what questions you're going to have on the ballot paper. Would it be, this deal, no deal, or remain in the EU? And of course, the argument from Brexiteers there is the first two questions would split the Brexit vote. And that whole process would take a lot of time, and you would absolutely need to extend Article 50 in order for that to happen. There's an interesting story, actually, as well, that the Scottish government, or I think a delegation in Scotland, perhaps took a case to the UK courts to see if the Article 50 process could be unilaterally revoked by the UK, and that was rejected, and then it was there was an appeal brought, and then it was going to be sent to it has been sent to the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg, and now the Secretary of State has lodged an appeal to stop that process so that you can't have an opinion from the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg as to whether or not the UK can unilaterally revoke Article 50. But in answer to your question, it is fraught with difficulty, and the first thing you would need to do would be to extend Article 50.
What's next? I presume next steps are, you know, what the upcoming summit on the 25th of November, or are there other incremental steps between now and then that are key and worth watching?
Yeah, so the process here is, or officials in Brussels and the task force and the member states are sticking rigidly to process and rather than pronouncing on what's happening in Brussels. So in a somewhat incongruous sense, things have been kind of ticking over as normal in Brussels. So yesterday, for example, there was a meeting of the Working Party. That's the officials that represent member states in Brussels. They were assessing the freshly printed withdrawal agreement. Today there was a meeting of EU ambassadors who were addressed by Michel Barnier. Now they were talking not about the divorce treaty, but about the future and about this political declaration, which, as you know, will sit alongside this withdrawal treaty, and where we are with that. Now they're hoping to conclude that political declaration next week, and there will be stuff in there which will point to what this future trade agreement will like. I mean, Theresa May will hope that in that political declaration there will be lots of reassuring noises about this deep and wonderful free trade agreement that's going to emerge down the tracks, and that in turn will help her reassure people that, sure, look, this backs up will never be needed, so don't worry about it. So that's going to go ahead. There will be a meeting of European Affairs and Foreign Ministers on Monday in Brussels. Simon Coveney will be back at that. In fact, I think five government ministers altogether are going to come over, because there's also a defence meeting as well. And at that General Affairs Council, they will discuss the withdrawal treaty. They will try and set up the summit for next Sunday. But I think one thing is important to stress. The summit next Sunday on the 25th of November is not a negotiating summit. We're not going to be having teams kind of wading through this withdrawal agreement, trying to change bits and pieces here and there to suit the Conservatives. The treaty is negotiated to all intents and purposes. So the summit next Sunday is going to be a consummation or a coronation of this withdrawal treaty. And of course, Theresa May will look for and will be given all of the optics of support and endorsement from 27 EU leaders, including Leo Varadkar. And she will hope that will somehow give people pause for reflection in London. But who knows?
All right. It's a heavy document if people metaphorically or literally beat each other up with or over it. But that's us for Brexit Republic for this week. From me, Colm O'Mungine here in Dublin.
And from me, Tony Connolly in Brussels, and thanks as always for listening.